Welcome to Conscious Compassion, hosted by Charles Gray
and Laura Darrell. This podcast will share stories of the different ways that people deal with low moments in their lives.
How they manifest the drive to overcome obstacles and keep pushing forward. A fluid space with media, poetry, music, literary readings, or just plain storytelling.
Coupled with in-depth interviews of the storytellers so that listeners can learn, relate, and be inspired.
Spend a moment with us as we explore creative coping strategies for these chaotic times. Conscious Compassion.
Where we share because we care. Welcome to Conscious Compassion. I'm Laura Darrell.
And I'm Charles Gray.
And today we have a wonderful guest, Anne Arvia. Anne, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
So excited to have you. Anne and I met doing a production of Kid Victory at the Vineyard Theater off Broadway, John Kander and Greg Pierce musical. We went on to do a cast recording of it, and we fell deeply in love. But, you know, she has a dog, Lila, and she said there wasn't room in her apartment, so we had to figure out another...
One or the other.
Figured out another way. But, Anne, please give us some context before we get into the minutiae, or I guess what we're really here to talk about. I'd love to introduce our listeners to your life story and what brought you to this moment in time.
In 5,000 words or less.
Yes. Sum up your life in, 30 seconds, please. Thanks, Beth.
Let's see. I was born and raised on the far south side of Chicago, about 11 miles from the Indiana border. In a very Italian Catholic neighborhood. I think my being in the arts was somehow written in the stars because my mom's nickname for me when I was very little was Sarah Bernhardt, because apparently I could get really dramatic and turn on the waterworks at the drop of a hat. So that was already in place. And then I started taking piano lessons when I was 7 because I wanted to. Neither of my parents are musical. But for some reason, I wanted to do that, and they encouraged it and allowed it. And as with many people, a lot of my early musical stuff and singing was in church and a bit in school, in choirs and all of that. And I kind of happened into the business a little bit because my mom was not a stage mother at all. But I somehow started getting cast in things and got my union card when I was about 17.
Oh, wow.
And I knew I didn't want to go away to a college that was in the middle of a cornfield somewhere.
Why not?
As much as I love corn, and I do love a good ear of corn, I wanted to be able to start working. I didn't want to wait 4 years to start having a career. And so the gentleman who was really my mentor my last year of high school said, "You're going to go to DePaul and you're going to study with Ann Perillo." And not knowing any better, I said, "Okay." And I went and I auditioned and I got accepted into the program. And, back in the dark ages when that was, there were no musical theater degrees. That didn't exist. You had to either choose to be a theater major or a music major. So I was a music major with a specialty in voice and minored in theater. And promptly started working all the time. And I guess it was maybe 2.5 years into my college career, and I was madly studying in the dressing room during intermission of some show at a now defunct theater in Chicago. And one of the other gals in the show looked over and said, "Okay, let me get this straight. You're studying and paying a university to teach you what you're already getting paid to do?" And I said, "Yeah, it's kind of crazy, right?" And I promptly dropped out of school.
Oh, my.
Because
how did your parents take that?
You know, looking back at it, Charles, it really was amazing how non-combative they were about it. I think their position was, don't fight it, because if you do, she's just going to dig into her heels more. It'll just be worse. You know, being an Aries child, they just knew it would be worse.
I love it.
If they fought me.
Plus, maybe the fact that you were working so much wasn't such a bad sign.
Exactly. And I sold it to them as, I don't want to teach in a university or a college or a high school or anything. I want to perform. Right. And nobody really cares about your degree. You either go in and you have the high C or you don't have the high C.
Right.
And they couldn't really argue with that. So that set me off on a career. And I had a lovely, lovely career in Chicago for many years. And then round about, I guess it was the early to mid 90s, I had burned through two marriages, and more and more of my work was coming out of the East Coast. And I thought, you know, I don't want to go to my grave saying, what if? Let me think about going. And if it doesn't work, I can always come back here or go someplace else. And I was going away to do a summer stock gig, and I was going to be gone for, I guess, about 3 months. And I put my house up for sale, and it sold in a week.
Wow.
So I took that as a big sign from the universe that this was supposed to happen. And as soon as I got back and was putting my house into storage, of course, I was offered Rose in Gypsy at a theater in Chicago. So I wasn't going to turn down doing Mama Rose. And I thought, what a great way to leave the city. You know, really go out on a high note. And so I did that. And the theater put me up because I had no place to stay. I was now homeless.
Which is kind of great, really.
Which was great. It was perfect, actually.
Right.
And I stayed on to do one more show there. I did one of my many Mother Abbesses in Sound of Music. And a week before I was closing, I got a phone call from the company manager of Les Miserables, who I had a fairly long history with. And they said, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm about to close a show next Sunday. And they said, do you want to go back out on the tour for a bit? Somebody has a medical leave. So I thought, okay, my stuff's in storage anyway, sure. So I went out to the tour, and about a month before I was supposed to finish the tour, I got a call from the company manager of the Broadway company of Les Mis. And they said, this one gal is giving her notice and leaving the show. We hear you're planning on moving to New York. Would you like her trapped? And I basically said, well, let me think about that for a minute. Okay. So I got to move to New York with a Broadway job.
Wow.
I mean, how blessed was
charmed.
That?
Yes, it, exactly.
It was so charmed and blessed, and
meant to be.
I could not have asked for a better, softer landing.
So you're in New
York. So I came to Broadway. I moved to New York and came to Broadway, and then about, I guess it was maybe a little less than a, well, it was well less than a year that I was here doing the show. My voice teacher back in Chicago called me and said, have you ever thought about teaching a voice? And I said, no. Why? And she said, well, I have a couple of students who are graduating from DePaul who are planning on coming to New York. And her daughter Marie taught at Northwestern. And her daughter had a couple students who were planning on coming here. And she said, I'd like to send them to you. And I said, well, you know, I'm doing this little skit 8 times a week that's 3.5 hours long. I'm really not that interested. And she said, well, please just think about it. So I really did. I took a couple weeks to think on it. And I finally called her back and I said, okay, here's what I'm offering. if they're willing, I'll do sort of a trial for a month and see if I'm good at it, if I enjoy it, if I have the energy to do it. And if I don't, I promise you I will send them to somebody I trust who teaches a great healthy technique as well. And she said, fair enough. So she sent me some people. Marie sent me some people. And one of which was Kate Baldwin. And I really found that I loved it. And I had some things to say. And it was so gratifying to me, for me.
That's so cool.
To give somebody an adjustment and have it make a difference and have their eyes get big in the room and go, oh my God, did that just come out of me? Yep. Let's do it again. Make sure it wasn't a happy accident, you know? and I also found it was, a great, for lack of a better word, antidote or offset to the business here in New York, because kind of easy to get jaded and discouraged and, to have people in my apartment singing who were hopeful, who still thought everything was possible, was a really great thing for me psychologically. And I enjoyed the mentoring aspect of it. I really did.
That's awesome.
Smooth sailing always, or were there a couple bumps?
You know, there's always a couple of bumps, Laura. it's never a straight line. And, life always likes to throw you a few curveballs. Going back to my Chicago days, in the space of 10 months, my father died very suddenly at 61. He had an abdominal aortic aneurysm that burst. So I had had dinner with him and my mother on my night off. I was doing a production of Baby up at a theater in Chicago. I had dinner with them on my night off. And the next night we were at Places and the stage manager said, this was of course before cell phones. He said, you have a phone call. And I said, Michael, I'm ready to go on. He said, well, it's your mom. She's really upset. And they'd taken my dad to the ER and, she was hysterical, as you can imagine. And I thought she was being dramatical. I'm like, Mom, really, I got to do the show. Okay. And she's kind of doing the, you have to get here as soon as you can. And my then husband got on the phone and said, she's not kidding. It's bad. Get here as soon as you can. So I did the first act and they figured out some way to do the second act without me. Mm-hmm. And I jumped in the car and the next morning he was dead. And so he died.
You were how old?
I was 28. Within, 6 weeks, I divorced my first husband. And then 10 months after he died, I got diagnosed with cancer.
10 months after your father died.
Yeah.
Right.
And so I didn't really feel like I could tell my mom about that. I was an only child. And I thought.
And you're 29 and you've got a cancer diagnosis.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
And she, I just thought she was still so fragile about losing my dad. And having lost him so suddenly, mm-hmm. I thought, if I tell her I have been diagnosed with cancer, it's all over. So I was in rehearsal for a show at the time. It was the regional premiere of Rags. Not Ragtime, but Rags.
No, Rags. I remember it.
And everybody was there working on it. Stephen Schwartz was there and Charles Strauss and Joe Stein. And I had just gone in for my regular annual gynecological exam and my OB/GYN called me and said, I need to do a biopsy on you. Something looks suspicious. And I said, well, I'm in rehearsal. I really can't. And she was very insistent and said, I'll come in early before my normal office hours if you can get out of rehearsal until at least noon and then tell them you can't really be dancing the rest of the day. I said, okay. So I went in, again, thinking really nothing of it. And she called 3 days later and said, how soon can you be in the surgery?
Wow.
And, you know, there is nothing quite as stupid as a clueless 28-year-old who's just worried about the show she's doing. It was, I can't remember if it was the end of April or the beginning of May at this point, but it was somewhere in through there, like right around now. And I said, well, the show closes August 17th, so August 18th.
Priorities.
Priorities, yeah. Yes. And she kind of, you know, leveled her voice and said, seriously, Anne, how soon can you be in rehearsal, in surgery? And I said, well, let me talk to the theater and see what we can come up with. And basically, we struck a deal that I would open the show, they would get my understudy ready, and then I'd have the surgery. So 3 weeks later, I had surgery. I was supposed to be out of the show for a whole week. And they kept saying, is there any way you can come back in? Is there any way you can come back in? And of course, I went back sooner than I should have. I had the surgery on a Monday. I went back to work on Friday because I didn't quite understand at that point in my life that no was a complete sentence. Thank you, Oprah. And I got through it somehow. But I remember the gentleman who was the master electrician on the show said he had his finger on the master light dump button the whole show because he said, you were so white underneath your makeup, like you had makeup on, but you were just white. But I, you know, I got through that. I got through it somehow. I don't know. Does that qualify as a bump, Laura?
That definitely, those are a couple bumps. And you said you said you got through it somehow. Wanna unpack that somehow? What? Because you are one of the most resilient, hardworking people I know, and you have a great you have a great sense of humor. And, you know, what carried you through that time?
This is going to sound so glib, but I think it's actually true of that time. It was just the stupidity of youth.
That helped. Like
I was very lucky. I didn't have to have chemo or radiation because they got clean margins on everything. It was like I had this surgery, but I didn't have all the stuff that went along with cancer.
You just had the scare. You had the initial scare, but it was managed.
Yeah, like, I've got cancer, but yeah, okay, this is going to be fine. And it was. So I was able to kind of brush that off. And frankly, I didn't really get through it all that well or healthfully because it wasn't until I was in therapy as my second marriage was disintegrating. That was about 5 years later. I just did not deal with my father's death until then. It was so painful that I just decided that it was easier to kind of pretend he never existed.
Ooh.
And I was horrible to my poor mother, who was still talking about him like he was still alive.
How long had they been married?
30. Wow. No, I was a year older than I was. So they'd been together 29 years.
Okay.
For that time of, you know, had gotten married late in life for that generation. You know, sort of era and generation. And she would talk about him in the present and say things like, well, I don't think your dad would like that. And I would say something horrible along the lines of, well, then I guess it's a good thing he's dead.
Mm.
It wasn't until this wonderful therapist who I really sort of credit her with who I am today, because she really not only helped me deal with the second marriage ending, but I think helped me become a much more whole human being. And she was actually the one that gave me that wonderful Nelson Mandela inaugural speech, because I think at the time I had really kind of dimmed my light so that my then husband could feel better about himself. And that doesn't really work ultimately.
No.
But isn't that classic, though, for especially any woman prior to, I don't know, 2015? it seems as though any woman who is extrovertedly powerful always finds themselves in a position of having to play themselves down, at least in the presence of the man that they've chosen, because 99.9% of the time, somehow, they always manage to fall for a man who just can't hold it together, you know?
Yeah,
I have to credit, and I've met him a few times, and I really dig him, Stedman, because, you know, Stedman is steadfast. Mm. Oprah is omniscient, you know? And yet this man has stood by her through everything, everybody, every attack, every everything. And he's been consistent, and he's just been himself. And he's, you know, he has his life, she has hers, they have their life together, but he's always just kind of steady and there. And that is, it's alarmingly rare.
It is alarmingly rare. That's a really great way of putting it.
Sad way of putting it, but
yeah.
There's a strength to that, being able to take, being able to support a really strong woman and not see it as a personal reflection on you, on your weakness, that it doesn't translate into that.
It's expected that a woman is supposed to be proud and boastful of her excelling husband, but it's never considered to be. It only works in reverse if the woman looks like Zsa Zsa Gabor or something, and that is the aspect of her that the man is boastful and proud of. It's what she looks like. It's the fact that she's an amazing cook. It's the fact that she's an amazing mother, but certainly not the fact that she's a CEO of some major company or that she makes more money than he does, because that's just not acceptable.
It makes me think of The Crown. Did you guys see The Crown when she's like, bow? There was that scene at the throne and she was like, a strong man would be able to kneel to both, and he was like, because he was like, I'm not going to kneel to my wife.
Right. Is it to the queen or to my wife? Or
Yeah.
A strong man would be able to kneel to both. Yes, that's it. What were we saying?
I was going to say in this. Two things. One, you know, you opened an interesting nugget there, Charles.
He does that.
He does. He has that talent, doesn't he? You know, I think societally it is very, very difficult, and a rare man that is okay with making less money than his wife. Mm-hmm. I think it's one of the last taboos in our society. And I, unfortunately, was more successful than my husband's. Right. Who were also actors.
Oh.
In my mind, I thought, well, at a certain point when we have a family, this will have to change, because I'll be home being a mom for a while when the kid's really little, and he'll be the major provider at that point. But I don't think it landed on them that way. The other thing that came to mind when you said about powerful women sort of being drawn to men who are not as confident, seemingly, I think there are two sides to that one, because I think initially men are drawn to women who are powerful and women who are passionate about what they do and committed to what they do and great at what they do. Mm-hmm. And then over time, you get punished for the very same thing that first attracted them to you.
Right. Yep. Right.
It's a really, really screwed up double-edged sword.
Well, I think it's also exacerbated by our industry. Helen Hayes, I think, was quoted saying something along the lines of, the problem is that they go to bed with my character and they wake up with me.
There's a lot to be said for that.
And there's,
but that's probably why I've never dated a performer.
Very smart.
Ever.
Very, very smart.
Ever, ever, ever. I just, you know, it's like, I love you, boo. We can be friends, but that's about it.
Yeah.
Because there can only be one diva in this house, and it's got to be me.
It's got to be
me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. But that therapist was the one who gave me that Nelson Mandela speech.
Which we will be sharing later.
It really helped to see that in writing. And for the longest time, I would keep it with a magnet on my refrigerator door so that I could just see it and be reminded of it.
That's nice.
Because it is tempting to dim one's light.
To make other people feel good, especially,
yeah.
I think a lot of women, a lot of men too, are, people pleasers. You want to make everybody around you happy. You feel bad hogging all the spotlight. There has to be a give and take, but of course it never serves anyone to dim your light so that somebody else feels more comfortable. That just is a recipe for disaster.
Yeah.
Or divorce. All the divorce.
There you go. I hate to skew it in one direction, but just for the moment, because this is an observation that has haunted me forever. I've been in so many shows where I'm usually the first person out the door. Curtain comes down. I have got it down to a science. I am out of my clothes and I'm on my way home.
Wow.
And
I'm envious. I'm the last one.
People are always like, what are you doing? Aren't you going to hang out at the stage door? Aren't you going to go out with drinks? Aren't you going to this? Aren't you going to that? It's like, no, I'm going home because I have a relationship.
Yeah.
And the way you keep a relationship is by being in it.
Yeah.
Not by hanging out at the bar with your buddies all night. Sorry.
Exactly.
And I, you know, one of the things that it was one of those priority moments and just having to decide what was important to you. Because one of the things that I cannot help but notice, and this is the point I was trying to get to, so many, it seems like, especially for women, you are forced to make a choice. You can either have a career or you can have a relationship. But it is the rare few that successfully manage to have both. Most of the people who are the people that we just name drop in a heartbeat, you know, you can just do that laundry list of all these really super successful women, 87% of them are alone. Mm-hmm. And that just is something that has always haunted me. I just thought, how unfortunate. I just don't understand why, you know, if they can have so much success and be so passionate and so powerful and so accomplished in every other aspect of their lives, but when it comes to a relationship, that elusive person who is able to handle them being themselves.
Yeah.
Because that's really what it comes down to. It's not that they don't want it. They do. If you talk to any of them for 5 minutes, they'll all tell you, you know, it's their dream to have all of those other things and to feel complete and whole. And then so many of them end up going out and finding other ways. They'll adopt kids and do all kinds of things so that they can have the other things that they felt like they couldn't get without a relationship. They're like, okay, well, the relationship's not going to happen, so I'm just going to go ahead and make this part work because I can.
Right.
And that's always frustrated me. It really has. But sorry for the side.
No, it's a good side. It's a good side, you know, and one that I've certainly talked to a lot of people about. Because if I had a nickel for every time somebody said to me, how is it possible that you are single? I would have a lot of nickels. several people, you know, put theories forward, and a couple of straight men who I trust a great deal, both came up with the exact same theory. So I'm putting some money on it. Ooh. Which is, men need to be needed. And when someone is accomplished and financially secure and has all their shit together, a man doesn't feel, quote unquote, needed.
Which is really sad, because
I feel like that's so sad.
It brings it all down to power and money.
Yes.
Because the reality is, they are desperately needed, but what they're needed for is to be that grounding thing that you get to come home to. That person who will hold your hand and who knows and who you don't have to explain anything to. You can just be in their presence. That is power.
They're not only needed because of, you know, because they're bringing home the bacon in multiple different ways, all important, but sorry, I've tried to make a sex joke. This is not the podcast for that. But you know, it's like the woman, they both, you know, couples need emotional support. Like you just said, they need friendship. Like there are many needs which are not just money and power. You said it well.
It's funny because at this point in my life, the magic shop is closed, so I'm not going to have children. That's a non-issue.
The magic shop, I love that.
Beautifully put, thank you.
Well, you know, the last egg has gone bad years ago. Anyway.
No more omelets. Oh, well.
No more omelets. No more omelets.
Sorry, too much. All right.
I don't feel any compelling need to marry a third time. I suppose if I met someone and he really felt strongly about it, I have nothing against the institution. I think it's, if you choose a partner well and wisely, I think it's a great institution and a great vehicle for personal growth.
Don't you think marriage is less important as you get older?
Absolutely.
I think it's a young institution. You know, I mean, it makes sense when you're going to have children. It makes sense when you want to claim someone, so that somebody else doesn't come along and snatch them up. But when you get older, you know, you've been through it all. And
what about medical
choice?
Trauma, like I want to get into the room in the hospital sort of thing.
Well, that's a whole different thing, but that kind of comes into it. But I think when you're older and you meet someone, it is a really conscious commitment, and you both understand that. And because of that, you've already covered it. I mean, we weren't allowed, obviously, to get married until God knows when. So, I mean, we were in our 50s when we legally got hitched. And
right.
I was almost against it until I wasn't. and found myself thinking, and I said, you know, at the wedding, you know, to the group, you know, we're doing this, but we've already been together almost 20 years. So it's like, it's nice to have the paper, but the commitment was made years ago.
It was like more of a, maybe a renewal of your vows to each other in a way.
Well, we were starting a new life, you know. We were leaving New York and coming to New Jersey, which was like, you know, going to Wisconsin, as far as I was concerned. let's just make it legal and see how it goes. But still, it's a very, very different thing when you're older.
So you said that your relationship with your mom was kind of tested because of not dealing with your dad's death in a very healthy way. Did that relationship change with the therapy? Therapy's been a common theme in our podcast, as like, we're very pro-therapy.
And oh, good.
So do you find that the therapy helped connect again with mom? Or
absolutely. I think the biggest thing it helped me do was to see her as a flawed human like the rest of us, who was just trying to do the best she could with all the things that had happened to her in her life. And it's interesting, I think, when the pennies fall from your eyes and you see your parent as a person and not as somebody who's supposed to be infallible and powerful and have all the answers, it got much easier. It got much easier. It was very challenging when I announced I was moving to New York. She was a little woman. She was not even five. She was like maybe 4'10".
Oh, wow.
And it was amazing the heavy artillery she was able to pull out when I announced that I was going to make the move. And, you know, thank God I had been in therapy for a couple of years at that point. You know, she tried, "I'm all alone. You know, your father's gone. You're all I have." I mean, she got out the big guns. And I was able, you know, to look her in the eye and take her in my arms as she was crying and say, "Number one, you don't want me at your deathbed resenting you because I didn't live my own life. And number two, if you look at the past 2 years of my life, I have been home in my house that's several miles away from you for X number of weeks, which were not many weeks because I'd been away on jobs or on tour." And I said, "Stop having a relationship with my stuff in my house and have the relationship with me.
Right.
If anything happens, I can be on a plane and be to Chicago in 2 hours. I can get to you faster from New York than I could have gotten to you from some of these places I was on tour." And that kind of took care of it.
So therapy gave you the perspective and the strength to communicate in ways that were better for both of you.
Absolutely.
In the words of Lionel Richie, you have been therapized.
I am therapized.
Yes.
You know,
that was beautifully put. I love what you said there. That was brilliant.
Yeah. I've always been curious because I actually have never been to therapy, and maybe that's the problem, Ann Arvia.
is this selling you, Laura?
but how do you, like, I guess my fear is, this is kind of a side tangent, but finding the right therapist, I imagine, is key. Did you have any trouble with that, or did you kind of just gravitate to the right person?
You know, this is one of those things where I fully believe that the universe, God, our angels, whoever, make the right person show up at the right time in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
It just, over and over in my life, that has happened. And when I was looking for this therapist, it was a pretty dark moment. My second husband had revealed that he thought he was in love with the woman that he had been having an affair with when he was away on a job. I said, "Okay, I can't deal with this on my own." And I got out the phone book and I just started going down therapists in our area.
Wow.
And the first two weren't taking new patients. And then the third one said, "Well, I'm not taking new patients right now, but it sounds like you're in crisis. Why don't you guys come in tonight? I'll stay an extra hour past my office hours." I thought, wow, okay. And the other thing that was great about her is she said, "I'm a night person. I don't start seeing clients until noon, and I see them until 8. I thought, wow. This is a theater person.
Right.
This is my kind of woman. And so we went that night, and she had initially said, "You know, Let me do an intake with you, and then I will give you a recommendation of somebody to see." And so we went in and kind of, you know, did our dog and pony show of this is what's going on with us. And by the end of what turned out to be 2 hours, she said, you know, you've auditioned very well.
Oh, my.
She said, because I want to be selfish and I want to treat you myself. She said, I don't want to give you to somebody else. I think you guys are really special. And I think you're in a really precarious moment in your lives and in your marriage. And I don't know if we're going to be, quote unquote, saving the marriage. But no matter what happens, I want it to be done with love and done as consciously as possible, because you both deserve that. You each deserve that.
Oh, wow. That's really nice.
I thought, wow, this woman is amazing. Amazing. And so she wanted to see us together, and then she wanted to see us separately as well, individually, I should say. Mm-hmm. And I went in for my second individual with her. And she said, all right, let's talk about your hand in this. And I said, what? Let's talk about your hand in all of this. And I was outraged and livid. Mm-hmm. My hand in this, he's having an affair. You know, I mean, I was so righteously indignant.
Norman Desmond just popped up in your voice. You know. It's like, affair. I was like, oh my.
He's having the affair. I'm pure as the driven snow.
Love it.
And she was a rough taskmaster and made me look at my stuff in it. And ultimately we did separate and finally divorce after several years. But I continued to see her, I guess, for about 2 years after that, until the point where she said, you know what, if you're having a crisis, we can get back to work or have a phone session, but we're pretty much talking about movies and books and theater rather than what's going on with you, because you're doing great. And so we kind of stopped sessions at that point. But then a few years later, when my mom was essentially dying, she had she had Parkinson's, but she then had a very steep 6-month decline. Wow. And luckily her office was about a 5-minute drive from my mom's home. So every time I would be home to deal with the latest crisis with my mom, I would call her and say, Suzanne, is there any way you can see me? And God love her, she'd say, just bring me a sandwich or some soup and I'm done at 8 o'clock. Come at 8. Wow. And she would see me after hours and was a tremendous help, both in terms of helping me kind of navigate the geriatric system, which is its own language and thing unto itself, and yet you're plunged into it, and somebody's life actually hangs in the balance. So she helped with that, but the biggest thing she helped with was I was feeling such tremendous guilt about not wishing my mother dead, but wishing my mother dead. Mm. Because she was in such pain and done, you know, not unlike your play, Laura. She was done. And she had compression fractures in her back from osteoporosis. And there's nothing they can do when your spine is just compressing on itself. No. There's nothing to be done. It's just excruciatingly painful. And I remember going in one day and saying, Susanna, I must be the worst person on the face of the earth, because the last thought I have before I close my eyes is, please, God, take her. And she said, what are you saying? That's the most loving thing you can wish for her at this point. Mm-hmm. Why would you want her to remain alive and suffering like this? That is the most loving thing you can do. And she really got me through that next thing, that next rite of passage, where as you're an adult. I was 45 when my mom died, and suddenly you're an orphan. you know, here, the roles had reversed for years, and I was a successful person working on Broadway and making my own living and had money in the bank. And it shakes you to your core for a while, where you just, your little girl inside goes, oh, where's, what, who's going to catch me if I fall? Mm-hmm. You know, where's my safety net? Where's mommy and daddy? And so she kind of got me through that next rite of passage. Wow. She was great.
So we mentioned earlier the clip that, or the Nelson Mandela. Why did that name just sound so weird coming out of my mouth? Probably because I said it weird. but the I swear I'm not like on anything. It's just been a long day. But
just pour another bourbon. It's going to be okay. But, one ice cube. You don't want to dilute it too much.
Right. Let it do its work.
Yes.
His quote, which kind of got you through, was something you thought about when you were experiencing rough times with men in your life who maybe, and other people who felt, who made you feel like you had to dim your life. Then there's also the other quote or letter that we're going to share on this podcast that you so kindly performed for us. Can you tell us a little bit about the significance of the other piece that we're going to be sharing with our listeners?
Well, it's a letter that Martha Graham wrote to Agnes DeMille. And I think for those of us who are perfectionists and expect so much of ourselves, it's a phenomenal letter because it speaks to that. And when I first read it, to comprehend that Agnes DeMille must have been feeling what I feel was kind of mind-blowing, because you go, you're Agnes DeMille, for God's sake. But clearly, no matter what heights you reach, you still wrestle with the same demons.
Right.
That never really goes away. But again, I think having a context to put it in and a way to frame it really helps. And I think her letter, I don't know if it's made me a better performer. I think it's made me a better auditioner, because it talks about impulse and creativity and how we should not judge ourselves. We should just do, like, just do the thing, be the channel for it, be the conduit. Others are going to judge you. That will be their pleasure to judge you. Why not give yourself a break? So I often, in a rehearsal process at some juncture or through the entire rehearsal process, will turn to that letter. A couple of years ago, I, for the first time as a professional, did a Shakespeare play, and I was playing the nurse in Romeo and Juliet. So, like, what a thing to launch. Mm-hmm. And I was down at Alabama Shakespeare Festival with people who knew their Shakespeare inside out. And I was wrestling mightily with imposter syndrome.
Mm.
And I'd worked really hard before I even got to rehearsals. Like, I had coached it here. I had done all sorts of research. And one of my dear friends, who's a very talented actor and playwright, said, you know, acting is acting. And there's nothing magical about Shakespeare. Just be a good actor. And you are that. So just go do that. And P.S., people who do musicals do really well with Shakespeare because you hear the rhythm of the language. Right. You naturally feel the music of his language. And I would be in rehearsal and I would see these people doing phenomenal work. And I was, you know, doing my thing. And I would come home at night and think, oh my God, do they know? Have they figured out I don't know what I'm doing yet? And I would dig out the Martha Graham letter and I would read it. I would think, okay, they hired you. They haven't fired you yet. Just keep doing the work. Just put one foot in front of the other.
I think I need to get a tattoo of that letter.
Right. I hope you have long arms. Yes, it's going to be a big, it's going to be a big tattoo. Yeah. And then one by one, in just the loveliest way, some of these other cast members were randomly coming up to me and saying, okay, I just heard something and I don't believe them. So I thought I'd come to you and ask you. Somebody just told me this is your first Shakespeare. I said, yeah, it's true.
It's true.
It's true. And the one guy who, I forget where he had his master's from, you know, and he's like, okay, I'm so mad at you right now because I have spent so much money and spent so many years and you just are doing it all naturally. Like you did it at the table read. And I thought, God, this woman's a heavy hitter. How do I not know her? And I promptly burst into tears. I said, you have no idea how much that means to me. And he was like, oh my God, just let all the doubts go. Cause you're doing beautiful work and you're coming up with creative things that I've never seen any other nurse do.
Yeah.
That's making me think, why hasn't anybody thought of that before?
You're a fountain of creativity. You really are.
Just because I had you lick the wall?
You did. So for our listeners who couldn't fathom what that reference means.
Please explain that reference because it's one of my favorite things ever.
We were working on an audition for Frozen, putting on tape. There was a scene where Anna, she spent the whole, you know, show chasing after, essentially, really trying to find her sister because her sister stormed off. And then she finds herself in her sister's ice castle looking around, waiting for her sister to show up so she can convince her to come back home with her. And I really wanted to help set the scene. And somehow Anne was like, well, I mean, what if you're looking around, you know, but like you really need to interact more with your surroundings. So, I mean, what if you licked the ice a little bit and then got stuck? And I just thought that is utter brilliance. Yes. And it was so fun, you know, and I thought, like, how many other, we created this whole comedic physical bit together before the scene had even begun. And I thought, you know, like, they're either going to really appreciate this and enjoy this, or they're going to think I've lost my mind. But I know that I've had the most amount of fun that I could possibly have. And so it's a win no matter what decision gets made. And I just think, right? Anne is a source for that kind of work. I've worked with Anne professionally on stage, but then I've also coached with her because I just think she has such a unique vision, and she gets me to laugh at myself when I'm taking myself way too seriously. Yeah. And I think that's critical. We all need people like that in our lives. So thank you, Anne.
Thank you, Laura. My pleasure.
And that's to get all of you out there who are considering studying with Anne to study with her and coach with her because she is great.
I believe I smell a plug. That works so well. I think the wonderful takeaway of all this is self-confidence, but not in a stuck-up kind of way, but just in a peaceful, forgive yourself, love yourself, don't beat yourself up too much. Just trust that what you're giving is so uniquely you that it is enough.
That's pretty much the crux of it, isn't it, Charles? I am enough. Yeah. We so often don't think we are in life, or God knows in this business.
But just in life, enough. for anybody. Yeah. I mean, and it ties in to the relationship stuff. It ties into the family stuff. It ties into everything, because I think if we could accept what we are, how we are, and be more forgiving of ourselves, then we wouldn't be so hard on everybody else, because we wouldn't be trying to prove something. Half the time that people are beating up on others, it's because they're trying to prove something to themselves. You know, so if we could find a way to just be a little kinder to ourselves, perhaps we could be kinder to everybody else in the process, and things might not be quite as harsh. At least that's my idealistic way of thinking about it.
I think you're onto something.
I love that.
I think that's a beautiful way to bring this to a close. Anne, thank you so much for joining us and for being vulnerable to tell your story. And we are so excited to share your pieces with our listeners.
Absolutely.
Thank you
it's
for your
wonderful speaking to you. I'm
gifts.
So glad we got
Likewise.
A chance to meet this
Thank way. You. Thank you for the opportunity. This has been lovely. It was like a therapy session, but cheaper.
But cheaper,
Much cheaper. And and you taught us so much, so.
We're going to end this session with two separate readings that Anne has offered us, one from Martha Graham and the other one from Nelson Mandela. I think they are going to be insightful and powerful pieces that should speak to everyone. Enjoy.
There is a vitality, a life force, a quickening that is translated through you into action. And because there is only one of you in all time, this expression is unique. If you block it, it will never exist through any other medium and be lost. The world will not have it. It is not your business to determine how good it is, nor how valuable it is, nor how it compares with other expressions. It is your business to keep it yours, clearly and directly, to keep the channel open. You do not even have to believe in yourself or your work. You have to keep open and aware directly of the urges that motivate you. Keep the channel open. No artist is pleased. There is no satisfaction whatever at any time. There is only a queer divine dissatisfaction, a blessed unrest that keeps us marching and makes us more alive than the others. Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, and fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. Your playing small does not serve the world. There is nothing lightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We were born to make manifest the glory of God that is within us. It's not just in some of us. It's in everyone. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our fear, our presence automatically liberates others.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Conscious Compassion. We'd love to hear your input and to hear what you do to make it through.
You can reach us on our website at consciouscompassion.net. We've got some amazing interviews coming up that we can't wait for you to hear.
Until then, catch you next time. I'm Charles Gray.
And I'm Laura Darrell.
Conscious Compassion.
Where sharing is caring.